Okay, so
Go
this
ahead.
we're going to look at this coming week's parsha, Parshas Vayeshev. So this is where, so they finally, Jacob gets back to the land of Israel.
Okay.
And it says that he settled in the land where his father had sojourned, the land of Canaan. So they say that he wanted to, you know, kind of Vayeshev, the idea of settling means he wants to kind of, you know, now, after working so hard all those years, kind of take it easy and, like, you know, let life, you know, be a little bit more right. simple. And Hashem says, doesn't work that way. So things get fun here. So this is the amazing story of Joseph. And this story of Joseph is really a precursor. And there are certain themes that occur with Joseph and the brothers that actually tie into Hanukkah. Which
really,
yeah. So, but let's look at the story first, and look at the subtlety in the language of the text, because it's amazing. Like these little hints and nuances that speak volumes. So these are Ela toldot Yaakov. So these are the, this is the toldot. These are the this is the like offspring of Jacob.
Isn't that the name of the parsha too?
Yeah, also, right. It's the parsha of when we have the whole story with Isaac and the fact that he's going to have the twins, okay. Jacob and Esau. Now we have the same.
By the way,
yeah.
One of the oldest documentation of likely a twin to twin transfusion.
Is it what?
You know how, like, sometimes you have twins and one of them steals the blood of the other?
Yes.
And one of them is very red.
Ah, that's interesting.
Twin to twin transfusion. Anyway, go ahead.
Wow. Okay, that's very interesting. Okay, to me too.
And I got another one. Goliath probably had a pituitary tumor. I'm serious.
I'm no problem. All right.
I'll tell you why later.
Okay. So fine. So now we have toldot. So these are the toldot of Jacob, and who's that? Joseph. Joseph is 17 years old. He tended the flocks with his brothers as a helper to the sons of his father's wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. And Joseph brought bad reports of them to their father. So now, let's just look at the Hebrew here. So Joseph was 17 years old. He was a shepherd, et echav batzon. It's kind of an interesting, with his brothers or at his brothers. Or it's kind of a strange type of phraseology, batzona with the flock. Vuhu nahar, and he was a youth with, again, et b'nei Bilhah v'et b'nei Zilpah nishei aviv. He's with the sons of the concubines. He's really going and hanging with the sons. There were four sons that were born out of not from Leah or from Rachel, but from their handmaids who were given to Yaakov to have children, because the goal was to have 12. That was like the magic number of sons, which ended up becoming the 12 tribes. So the Bilhah and Zilpah. So it's interesting how it says that he's hanging with, not with the major, with the sons of Leah, or with his brother, for that matter, Benjamin, at this point, which is interesting. But it says, v'hunar et b'nei Bilhah et b'nei Zilpah neshei aviv. So neshei aviv. So here we see that they are, b'nei Bilhah and Zilpah are being identified as the wives of, which in the past, maybe they weren't identified that way. For example, if we go back, let's just go back to when we have the confrontation between when Jacob finally meets up with Esav. So it describes the confrontation or the meeting, and it talks about the idea of how they met him. So here comes Esav. Jacob raises his eyes and he sees Esav coming. And then it says he put the maids and their children first. Then Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. So Bilhah and Zilpah are not considered to be wives if you go back a sentence in chapter 33 here, he says, looking up, Jacob saw Esau coming, accompanied by 400 men. He, meaning Jacob, divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maids, putting the maids and their children first. So he's referring, so you see in chapter 33 that they're referred to as maids, right? It's interesting. And then we come to our parsha now. When it comes to Joseph's, who he's spending his time with, it refers to Bilhah and Zilpah as Neshe Aviv, the wives of, the wives of his father's wives. So it's interesting to see he's not hanging with the sons of the major wife, Leah, but rather of Bilhah and Zilpah, which is strange. It's very strange to see that kind of, and this Rashi, right? So meaning, what's he doing with them? Meaning that he made it his custom to associate with the sons of Bilhah because his brothers slighted them as being sons of a handmaid. Therefore, he fraternized with them. So Rashi's pointing out, he's noticing, Rashi always will go and say, this is weird. Like, what's he doing hanging with them? And I think it's interesting that now they're being referred to as Neshe Aviv, right? That they're now, all of a sudden, they're the wives, whereas before, they weren't. So they were the maids, the maid servants, not necessarily the full wives. Now, what's interesting also is the fact that he's being called Hunar. He's considered to be a youth. Okay, that there's something. So we also see this idea that he's being, that there's something. You know, he's immature at this point. Ramban says that he's playing with his hair. He's doing things that like he's looking at himself in the mirror. You know, he's a little bit on the vain side. Okay. So there's a certain youthful or immaturity that Joseph is displaying. And then it says that Joseph brought dibatam alavihem. He brought bad reports to their father. Now, vayave Yosef et dibatam ra'a alavihem. There's a certain ambiguity here again, that he's bringing negative reports to the father. Dibatam ra'a elavihen. It's like, who is he talking about? Like, who did he bring reports about? Did he bring it about the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah? Or is he bringing it about all of his brothers? It's not clear. Right? You see that ambiguity there, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just see. So Rashi says, whatever he saw wrong in his brothers, the sons of Leah, he reported to his father. So it's interesting. Rashi, and you know, it's interesting that it's being focused on Leah, the sons of Leah. Now, how did Rashi see that in that?
Yeah, why? How do you know he's talking about them?
Right. So it's interesting that that would be. Let's see something here. So where does Rashi see that? And then he goes on the whole thing. He's basing it on maybe, you know, it's interesting that the fact that he's hanging with the B'nai Bilhah, B'nai Zilpah, because there's something deficient about them, that they're not being treated as, you know, they're second class in a sense. And maybe that's why it connected to that, and therefore Joseph's bringing negative speech about the other brothers who weren't treating those B'nai Bilhah, B'nai Zilpah properly. Okay.
Okay.
And of course, what happens now? Israel. Now, here, check this out. It starts out and says, "These are the chronicles." Let's say the toldos of Jacob. Okay. Then what does it say in verse 3? V'Yisrael, Israel, loved Joseph from more than all of his other sons.
Yeah, I've never understood the name change.
Okay, that's something that has to be. It's pretty unbelievable. Basically, there are two identities that the same person has. There's Yaakov, there's Jacob, and there's Yisrael, there's Israel. Same person. But clearly the names that he'll be referred to, it's not like Abraham, who was Avram, and then he becomes Avraham. Sarai became Sarah. So that their names change, and they never were referred to, except in reading the story, but he's known as Avraham, not Avram. and that his name change was permanent and you didn't go back to the old one. Here, Yaakov's name, Jacob, becomes Israel, and it becomes a name that is going to be used, both are going to be used. It's not like we canceled out the name Jacob. Now there's a whole...
Why?
So there's definitely, there's okay, so in terms of symbolism, Jacob, Yaakov, comes from the word Ekev, which is the heel. And that he held on to the heel of Esav as he was born, right? So there's something about him, heel is the lowest part, there's something on the lower end of the person. Israel, Yisrael, is coming from the name Kisarita Elim Emadim. Like he was able to be victorious over the highest level, and you know, he's basically victorious on the highest spiritual plane. So there's something about Yisrael, that Israel, that represents this lofty soul of the Jewish people, the collective Jewish soul. Like we say, for example, "Hear, O Israel, Shema Yisrael." Who are we talking to? Like, "Hear, Israel." Like, who's that? Who are we calling to? So in a sense, there's something about, like, Yisrael is this idea of the Jewish, I shouldn't say Jewish, it's Israel, is that there is a collective soul of Israel that is this entity, this meta entity that's much greater than any one individual, but that at the same time Jacob took on this, you know, role of being the beginning of that whole identity, let's say.
Okay.
So in a sense, it really represents the loftier, higher place of the Jewish people. But when I say Jewish, it's like, oh my God, I have to say Israel.
What's that?
You know, it's Israel, the children of Israel, is not the same as Jewish. Jewish is coming from the word Judah, Judaism. Right, it's coming from Judah being one of the sons of Jacob. That, you know, the I guess the monarchy of Israel comes from that line, and we became known as Jews because after the 10 tribes get taken away, you're left with 2 tribes and maybe a third. So you're left with the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, and, you know, Levi, the Levim. And the Kohanim, so those are coming from the same tribe of Levi, so they're still around. But the 10 tribes, you know, the 10 lost tribes, like we become identified as the Jewish people, which is maybe like more of a religion as opposed to the national identity. So like the idea, like, of the fact that the state became known as Israel as opposed to Judah or Judea, you know?
Right, yeah, why is that? Yeah.
So in a sense, it's almost like a prophetic type of understanding that the national identity of our people is Israel. And that it's a meta, there's a meta, like the greater soul of the people. Well, I would say the greater Jewish soul, but it's really Israel. So that when we call out Shema Yisrael, Hear, O Israel, we're kind of tapping into the greater, we're kind of like logging in, so to speak, to our greater collective soul.
Okay.
Which is kind of interesting, you know? So here he's, V'Yisrael Ahavat et Yosef Mikol Banav. So Israel loved Joseph best of all his sons. And why? So for he was the child of his old age. And he had, and then he made him this, what we call the Technicolor dream coat, right?
Vasalo
Ketonet Pasim, or the ornamented tunic. So now, but what's interesting here is the shift. So almost to say that there's something about Joseph that the identity Yisrael, Israel, loves, right? So there's something to think about. Like, what is that? Like this idea of Israel loving Joseph, and that what Joseph is more of, the outer, who does Joseph come from? He comes from, his mother is Rachel, the beautiful one, external beauty.
Right.
So he's definitely going to be the one who goes out into the world. He goes down to Egypt on his own. He becomes not just, he doesn't just make it there. He becomes like the number, he becomes, we call it Mitsuyan. He becomes like, he excels in that world, right? He becomes like the guy, right?
He's like the number 2 guy in Egypt.
Yeah, right. And everything runs through him. So it's an amazing ascent. But there's something about Joseph. So now let's see the early days of Joseph. So his brothers, See, Vayirachav ki oto ahav avihem mikol achav. So they saw that their father loved him more than all the other brothers, and therefore vayisne'u oto, they hated him. V'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom, and they could not speak a friendly word to them, of him, or to him. What's interesting is that they're praised for that, because at least they were like honest. We don't like you, and we can't pretend that we like you, you know? Okay, so then,
they were
fine.
They were jealous.
Well, right now it says that they hate him. There's no jealousy here. So far, you'll see. So then, once Joseph had a dream, which he told to his brothers, and they hated him even more. Okay, no jealousy yet. He said to them, "Hear this dream which I have dreamed." Okay, so he has two dreams. The first one, they were binding sheaves in the field, when suddenly my sheaf stood up and remained upright. Then your sheaves gathered around and bowed low to my sheaf. So what's interesting here, which I never really thought about, but I saw pointed out, is that their sheaf, it's not them, but rather their sheaf bowed down to his sheaf. So it's like, it's not personal in a sense. I mean, it's his, theirs, you know, fine, but it's not that they are bowing to him, but rather it's their possession is bowing down to his possession, which is something to think about. Okay, next. Then the brothers said to him, "Do you mean to reign over us? Do you mean to rule over us? Now, in Hamaloch Timloch, and will you be? Are you saying that you're going to be king over us? In Mashaltim Shalbanu, is are you going to rule over?" The difference between those, reign and rule, to be a king is to be have willing acceptance. Mashal, to be to rule over somebody, is to do it by force. So we think of royalty and we think of a king as oppressive, but the truth is a king is really there based on the will of the people. Like the idea of monarchy, like you could see in the British Empire, like the Brits, like they choose to have the king. That's there's no king without a nation. The nation chooses the king. So there's as opposed to a dictator, mashal, a ruler is to dictate to force yourself on someone. So they're saying two things. They're saying, "Do you think you're going to be our king? Do you think you're going to rule over us?" And then they additionally hated him more. Because of his talk about his dreams, or about his dreams and on his things, more literal. But it's interesting. They're dissecting a dream about food. Your food, our food's going to bow. Or he says to them, "Your food's going to bow down to my food." You know, it's like, which is interesting. That royalty is the idea of a king. The idea of food associated, connecting food to royalty. So this is an interesting observation I heard, is that when you don't have proper, government, proper rulership in a country, you'll find that they also have issues with the food supply. So like Africa struggles maybe more than anything else, is there's a corruption that's so deep, and there's a lack of true royalty or control in terms of governmental stability,
that leadership,
that therefore it in turn affects the food supply, and that's why they struggled all those years with food. Because it's related to having a king or something similar to a king, like in our case where we have democracies, but clearly we have a government that has power, and that power of government keeps everything running properly. So therefore, thank God, we have a healthy food supply. But when there's a breakdown potentially in that, God forbid, then you could have actually issues with food supply. So, but you see that they're connecting. Here he's having a dream about food bowing to other food, and they automatically translate that. They interpret into the idea that, you're dreaming about becoming our ruler, our king.
Becoming over us.
Right. And so food equals that. Okay, fine. Then you have a second dream. He dreamed another dream and told to his brother, saying, "Look, I've had another dream, At this time, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars are bowing down to me. Right? So here we've shifted now. The second dream is the sun, the moon, and 11 stars that are bowing to, directly to Joseph.
The 11 stars are the 11 tribes.
Correct. Correct. So what's interesting
is... Why does he just say tribes?
Because again... So listen to this. This is it. So the idea that he's having a dream about the symbolism of the father being equal to the sun and the mother as the moon, and then the 11 stars. It's like they say Joseph is having a dream about making his brothers into stars. But what's the nature of a star? Is that it's, as you get closer to it, you see that each star is this major, on its own is a major bright, source of light. It's an amazing thing. Like, I'm going to make you into a star. It's like, I'm going to make you stand out. I'm going to make you shine, So, but here you see a shift, and now he sees them. So it's interesting. So here he's having a dream about his father and mother also coming to bow to him, and that it's no longer about food per se. But it's interesting that he's definitely seeing them in a positive light, no pun intended, or maybe pun intended, right? Mm. It's all, okay, so now, what happens? And when he told it to his father and his brothers, his father berated him. His father got upset.
Yes.
And what he said to him, is this dream you have dreamed? Are we to come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow low to you to the ground? Right, so here's like, what kind of dream are you having that you're going to have your father and mother and your brothers bow to you? So what's interesting is his brother's reaction to this dream is that became jealous. This is where the jealousy comes. Vaykanubo echav. Again, we're brought up as not a good, they were jealous of him. So his brothers became jealous, and his father, Vaviv Shamar Tadavar, the father kept the matter in mind. So now, what changed here? Why all of a sudden are they jealous? And why is the father, who just said, what the heck are you dreaming about? But then at the same time said, is thinking, like, there's something here. The Aviv Shamar HaDavar is, he's like, watching this now. Okay? So there's something that's different about this dream. So, and to the point where the brothers, jealousy comes when you recognize that that someone has something that you don't have, or that it's real, that makes me jealous. What came up in this dream? So the idea that there's a principle that anything that's a prophetic vision in a dream, there has to be something that's not correct. And so what do we know about Joseph is that his mother had died. So the fact that he could see his mother in his dream bowing to him, it's just not possible. She's no longer. Right. So Yaakov recognizes that there's we call it davar shtus, like something that's not possible or plausible in the dream. So then already, he sees that as maybe there's something to this, And what is this dream though? And what's bothering the brothers, maybe two things. One is that they see that this is like prophetic, that there's something here. But at the same time, they're bothered more because of the shift right now. We're no longer talking about my quote-unquote produce bowing down to your produce or your means. My means are bowing down to your means that, you're going to be the breadwinner, the bread, supplier. But now it's this idea that you see us bowing directly to you. That's already, I'm bothered by that. But there's also this recognition that there might be something to this. And therefore, the jealousy starts, and the father is watching this. Now, we're about to go into this phase of where he's going to be sold down to slavery.
Right.
Right? So, but the idea here is that later on, what's interesting is Yaakov and the brothers, it's not like he's having dreams of power. But he's also having a dream about the idea of that he's going to take care of the family, right? The idea
Oh,
of
because he's going to reign over them.
he's going to reign over them. He's going to supply food to them, right? Because they say, like, the idea he's dreaming about his food, their food bowing to his food. That's like he's going to be the one who's going to be taking care of the family, right? So, I mean, who dreams about food? I mean, I do, but that's not a story, right? But I don't have anybody else's food bowing to my food, you know? So, like, you see this idea, though, that he's dreaming about taking care of them. And so, Va'aviv Shamarta Davar, this idea that his father is going to, like, keep the matter in mind, later on we see that there's something that bothers Jacob later on when Joseph sends to have his father come to Egypt. The strangest thing it says that when they told him that Joseph's still alive, he said, "I don't believe it." But then when he saw the wagons, when he saw the wagons, which represented the idea of being taken down and for Joseph to take care of the family, both, basically financially with food and etc., at that point, he believed it. And it says there that why? Because when they left, right before Joseph got sold, it says that Jacob was studying with him, and they were learning the laws of Eglah Rufa, the idea of the breaking of the neck of the heifer. And the idea of that story is that you have a body found between two towns, and it's unidentified. No one knows who this guy is. And what they do is they figure out which is the closest town, and the leaders of that town that are closest to the dead body are held responsible. But they have to say, "We did not spill this blood." Why would we even accuse this upstanding person of spilling innocent blood? Because they didn't set up the town to make sure that people who were traveling, that they would have some kind of entourage with them, that they were being watched over. Because if someone saw that people cared about that person, they would be careful not to kill them. The fact that they saw this guy walking on his own and no one cared about him, that they felt, okay, we could, start up with the guy, steal his money and kill him. But the idea of Eglah Rufa for the Parsha is the idea of leadership. That they were that Yaakov was really spending time with Joseph at that point, teaching or learning or studying with him the ideas of what it means to be a leader. Because he saw that that's what he was dreaming about. It's just that it wasn't refined at that point. So now the story goes on to where the brothers go to the place of Shechem, which is interesting. Shechem is always going to be in our history, always a problem spot. They go there to,
Is it?
even till today. It's always been a bit of, it's
Where is
a,
it? I never heard of it.
Shechem is in Israel.
I know, but okay.
Oh,
I know, but where?
it's in the territories where people don't go. It's actually an area. What do they call it? Area A. It's actually a apartheid city. No Jews are allowed.
Please.
It's like amazing. Okay, so it's a, you can look up Shechem. It's so Shechem. It was ended up giving being like goes to Joseph, but here they go out there to take the sheep. And they're shepherding there. And then here you have again the name Yisrael. Israel said to Joseph, "Your brothers are pasturing in Shechem. Come, I will send you to them." He answered, "I am ready." So crazy. So here, "Halo achecha roem, I want to go send you to them." And he says, "I'm here. Hineni, I'm present." So he says, Vayomer lo, he says to him, "Go and see how your brothers are and how the flocks are faring, and bring me back word. Lech na re'eh et shalom achecha, ve'et shalom hatzon, v'hashiveni davar." It's interesting. So go see the peace of, right? So go see the peace of your brothers. Right here, he's saying how see how your brothers are doing, but here it's like the word shalom comes twice, and return to me a thing. So he sends him from the valley of Hebron, and he reached Shechem. Now, he's walking along, right? And here, I love this. We had this last week. Vayim sa'ehu ish. A guy found him. Who is this mysterious man? We don't know. Again, it's ambiguous. Some guy, right? V'hinei to'e basadeh. He's wandering in the field. V'hinei to'e basadeh. Who's wandering? Is it the man that's wandering? Is it Joseph? I don't know. V'yishalehu ha'ish le'mor matev akesh. And the ish, asks him, "What are you looking for? Matvakesh." So he answered, "I am looking for my brothers. Could you tell me where they are pasturing?" So they say, "Anochi." I say, "Vayomer es achai anochi mevakesh." My brothers, or I'm looking for my brothers. Anochi, it's interesting, is a shift. Anochi is a very, there are different ways of saying I. Anochi is the most personal, most deep identification of oneself. Anochi. What?
Versus just ani.
Yeah, yeah. It's much more, there's, anochi is like when God identifies himself to the Jewish people, the first of the Ten Commandments is, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am Hashem, your God. Anochi. It's like a very, it's pretty, it's very personal.
Okay.
Okay, and so they say like a play on this, that Achai, it's Achai Anochi Mivakesh. I'm looking for my brothers. Could be looking and saying, I'm looking for my brothers to be brothers. I'm looking for my brotherhood. You know, it's a very interesting. So can you tell me where they are? And the man says, again, very ambiguous, the man, Ha'ish.
The man, who is this person, right?
So it could be like, you know, when we see the man, right? So many times that is like Eliyahu HaNavi. But here, I mean, it's pre-Eliyahu. It's not even, he's not even been born yet. But let's see something here. Does it tell us who is this? Who is this Ish? Let's see, right? So Rashi says he's the angel Gabriel. Because you see in other places, V'ha'ish is Gavriel. V'ha'ish Gavriel. So you see that, but but it's like, again, like, whereas when the Ish came and wrestled with Yaakov, right, it was an Ish also. Again, the ambiguous Ish. So it's just, whereas the Ibn Ezra is more, according to the plain meaning of the text, a passerby found him, right? I'm not going to go deep. I'm not going to call it an angel Gabriel, right?
Okay.
So Ibn Ezra is much more, it's interesting, like the different commentators have different approaches. Fine. So he's looking for his brothers. He's looking for much more. And then the man says, they went from here. I heard them going to Dosina. He found them in this place called Dotan. Now it's interesting in Hebrew, in modern Hebrew, they call a religious person a dati, which is, you know, so like they went to the place called religion, and he found them in the place of religion, which is kind of like, we'll see that Judah and Joseph, like the two factions, really become like, there's this idea of Mashiach ben Yosef, the Mashiach that comes from, that's the son of Joseph, and Mashiach ben David, that of the son of King David, which is coming from Judah, that there's something, they run parallel in these, and we'll see in these parashat of the story of Judah and Joseph going back and forth between the two, because they represent two different things. Judah becomes more of the internal aspect of the Jewish people, more internal and inward. And Joseph is more of the outward, more going and actually confronting more of the outside world. As we see that Joseph goes down to Egypt, he confronts it and he integrates and he excels within that world. And Judah is later on sent down to Egypt to create the infrastructure for the Jewish people to survive their years in Egypt. So you see once more of that, you know, that the Judah, or you could translate it as, the fact that the brothers went to a place of religion, that the more of the religious type of approach to things will be expressed through Judah and Joseph. Not, it's like a different, more, I'll leave it there. Like the more of the philosophical outside approach to things will be more expressed within a Joseph approach to things as opposed to the Judah approach. But that's like being, you know, very, you know, simplifying right now, but we'll leave it like that. But the brothers are going to that place called Dotan, and they see him from afar. And before they got there, before he gets there, they're already conspiring to kill him.
Oh boy!
And now look at this: Vayomru Ish El Achiv. Again, that word, that the man, Vayomru Ish El Achiv. The man said to his brother, Hinei balachal motal azaba, the dreamer's coming. So now, v'yata lechu v'nargeu v'nashlichil b'achar avor, let's go and kill him and send him, throw him into one of the pits. V'amarnu chayim will say, he got killed by a wild animal. And then we'll see what happens to his dreams. Reuben hears this, and he wants to save him from them. He said, don't take his life. So then Reuben says, shed no blood, cast him into the pit out in the wilderness, but do not touch him yourselves, intending to save him from them and restore him to his father. So here he says, let's not kill him. Put him in the pit. If you want to get rid of him, at least don't kill him. Let it happen on its own. But his mind, he was saying, I'm doing this so he can come back and save him.
Yes.
Comes Joseph. When Joseph came up to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, of course, in order that right
the coat
that he had given, that special gift that was given to him by his father. There's a lot of discussion as to what exactly that was, but fine. They take him and they throw him into the pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. Now it's kind of strange. Why do you have to tell me if it's empty? Why do you have to tell me there's no water? Because, right, read between the lines. It's true there was no water in there, but it wasn't empty. It had snakes and scorpions. Okay, so not the nicest pit to be thrown in. So then this is really what's sick, in a certain sense. This is pretty harsh. They throw him into there, not a nice place, perhaps till die. And then they sat down to eat a meal. Looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilad, their camels bearing gum balm and ladanum to be taken to Egypt. Okay. So, what's interesting? Why does the Torah, why does the tell us what they're carrying? Because they were bringing, they had some. It was actually a nice smell. It was, as opposed to some disgusting, you know, like that they weren't carrying manure, but they were carrying good smelling things, which is nice that Joseph was at least able to travel in pleasant smelling surroundings. Then Judah wakes up and says to his brothers, what do we gain by killing our brother and covering up his blood? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let us not do away with him ourselves. After all, he is our brother, our flesh. His brothers agreed. So here it says that Reuben left at this point before this discussion. When he came, he actually comes back to think that he's going to get him out of the pit. He had been taken out and sold. Again, it's interesting that Judah is like, let's make some money on this deal. If we're going to sell him, let's at least get some, you know, whatever.
Get some out of it.
Fine. So then it says, it's kind of interesting here, because let's sell him. But then it says that the Midianites, now this before was the Ishmaelites. Now some Midianites traders passed by. They pulled Joseph up out of the pit. They sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites who brought Joseph to Egypt. Who sold him? They sold him. It sounds like the Midianite traders sold him.
Yes.
So what's interesting is, did the brothers actually sell him in the end? Not clear. Later on, Joseph says he was sold, but who sold him? Maybe it was the Midianites, it wasn't the brothers, but they're held accountable over history because that was their intent. Did they actually sell him? Was it someone else? So that needs, like, okay, open-ended, okay? You see that Reuben comes back to the pit, saw that Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes because he thought bad stuff happened. Returning to his brother, he said, the boy's gone. Now, what am I to do? Right? So there's something off about Reuben, that what am I to do? It's like, vani ana aniva, like, what's going to happen with me? Like, he sensed that he messed up here. But it's also messed up in that, and you see that with Reuben, he seems to, whenever he says things, like, he's always a little bit, there's something a little bit subtly off. Like, is it about you? You know, like, what about the boy? Like, you know, the boy's gone. Now what about me? I'm lost. Like, but it's not all about you, but okay, fine. So that's Reuven. Like, you see that there's certain deficiencies in Reuven. He's done things already now. He either had relations with one of the maidservants, or, you know, his father's maidservant, or he did something that messed up, whatever. So he's done something wrong there. And now he's also had this plan of selling Joseph, and that didn't go well. So he ends up really forfeiting on many different levels the firstborn rights. Okay, fine. What they do, though, is they do the cover-up. They took his tunic, they slaughtered a kid, and dipped the tunic in the blood. And then they sent that, and they brought it to their father, and they said, "What? Look what we found." So now they're saying, like, you know, they want to make it out like, you know, he was something bad happened to him. "We found this. Please examine it. Is it your son's tunic or not?" He recognized him and said, "My son's tunic, a savage beast devoured him. Joseph was torn by a beast." So, you know, very bad. They you know, very subtly, they set it up so that they don't have to come to that conclusion, but clearly their father does. And they don't step in to say anything. And here the brothers, you see Jacob rent. Now, what's interesting, what happens? He was sent as Israel, right? He says that Yisrael called Yosef, right? To send him down to go. And then we see that now he returns to being Vayikra. Jacob rent his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and observed mourning for his son many days. So you see a shift. He's no longer Israel. He's now back to being Jacob in his mourning, which is interesting. Right? And they say that from here on, for the next X amount of years, his 22 years, he loses his ability to have prophetic connection. So he's in a state of 22 years of just not good. Now, all of his sons and daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, saying, "No, I will go down mourning to my son in Sheol," like to purgatory. And Vayecha to Aviv, and his father bewailed, be cried for him. So like here you have, they set it up, and he refused to be comforted. Okay, so you see that it's like something that never, you know, the father, but they say that he sensed, in a sense, there was no closure there. And so it just goes on for those 22 years. The Midianites, meanwhile, sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh, and his chief steward. So they sell him.
Yes.
Okay. So now, just as a quick, and then Judah ends up going off because the brothers basically, they held him accountable. You're the one who basically set this up. It went off bad. Our father is in mourning. He ends up leaving the family and goes off to get, away from them. He ends up getting married, has three boys, and he has a daughter-in-law, Tamar. Two of the sons die. The whole idea of whatever of this story here is that one son died because he says here. So first, the oldest one of Yehuda was heir, and it says first it says that he married Judah married his son off to a woman named Tamar. Says that he was doing things that were bad in God's eyes, and God killed him. Then Judah had Onan marry his daughter-in-law because he died childless. So he should do Yibam, levirate marriage. And Onan refused to impregnate her. Basically, he would not ejaculate within her as to not let her have, he did not want to impregnate her. And God looked at that. This idea of God, the word Onanism. You ever hear that word?
Say again?
Onanism.
No, I don't know that one.
So Onanism is like idea of like not wanting to like ejaculate inside the woman. Perhaps it's masturbation. I don't know. I think it's like more just that the way I put it first. So his comes from the word Onan. Because that's what he was doing here. Onanism.
I've never heard that. Okay.
Okay. So you can look it up after. And he also dies. Then Judah at that point is like, okay, two sons died being married to this woman. I'm not going to give her to my third son, Shelah. It ends up that she dresses up when she realizes that Judah's not going to have the third son marry her. But she understands prophetically that she needs to have a child from this family. She ends up dressing up as a prostitute. Judah's wife had died. And he sees her in the way and ends up having relations with her. And she becomes pregnant. And that is where the house of David. So King David is going to come from there, which is amazing. We see this multiple times within the lineage of the building of the Davidic dynasty, these crazy stories, because Judah also comes from, or sorry, David comes from Sodom, meaning Lot, who ends up surviving with his two daughters, the oldest daughter, they think that there's no one else alive. they get their father Lot drunk, and then they have relations with him, and that first child that's born is named Midian. I'm sorry, Moab. Moab, from my father.
Okay.
From Moab comes Ruth. Ruth is the one who ends up marrying Boaz, and from there, King David's like great-grandmother is Ruth, who came from Moab. Also from a crazy, you know, so like, you're talking from Tamar, and it's like, so the whole Davidic dynasty is built on this weird stuff that's going on. So there's something to be, that's a whole nother discussion. But from this story here, you see that this is what's going on. It says that as the whole family of Yaakov, of Jacob and Yisrael, comes to this crazy story of Joseph going down and thrown into the difficulties in Egypt, and Judah goes off and he has all these issues, and Jacob is sitting there crying. Everybody's upside down, okay? And it says, and what's God doing? He's getting everything organized for the planting the seeds of the Messiah.
I see.
So like this stuff is happening. It's like Hashem is sitting there, and we're seeing the unfolding of, you know, right now is like the beginning seeds of the beginning of Mashiach. And that you see from Peretz is born from this relationship that Judah has with Tamar. And Peretz is the one, later on, we'll see, he's again the progenitor of King David. It's amazing.
Okay.
Who's going to end up being, okay, so just, and then Joseph gets thrown down to Egypt. He ends up being, become the number one person in Potiphar's house.
Right.
And you know the story, and she wants to have relations with him. He ends up almost giving in, but doesn't. And then she ends up incriminating him, and he gets thrown into jail. So here's this guy. The most amazing thing about Joseph, we'll leave it here on this.
Okay.
And one other thing I have to show you, this is just amazing. I'll show you this very cool chidah. But the amazing thing about Joseph is the whole way he seems to bounce back. It's an incredible thing. Right. He gets thrown, he gets sold by his brothers. He becomes the number one guy in Potiphar's house. He gets thrown in jail. He excels in jail. They love him there. It says, the chief jailer did not supervise anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made successful. So it's an incredible thing that Vashehu Oseh Hashem Matzliach, and it's like known. Like people see it, they understand that there's something special about this Joseph, but an incredible ability to bounce back from difficulties.
Right.
Okay. So now, the cupbearer and the baker, they get thrown into jail, okay? And these are like the top guys. These are like the chiefs of staff of Pharaoh.
Right.
Now they're in the same jail as Joseph, so they must be in a political, you know, in the politically, you know, the political, you know,
called club fed,
right?
Club fed,
yeah, but it's still not a good place. Okay, fine. So each one of these guys has a dream, and Joseph
interprets the
dream. Okay, right. So now, how did Joseph know to interpret this dream? Like, what did he see in the dream? Okay. Did he get some prophetic vision? Did God speak to him? And the answer is, doesn't say anything in the text about God speaking to him about anything. And that goes for that matter, we'll see next week, that God doesn't tell him, but he says, Elokim, halole Elokim petronim sepunali. Surely God can interpret. But Elokim is the name of the not God in nature. So like he's saying there's something that God, like God can interpret, but it's something that he says, like, let's look for the hand of God in this dream, and then it will be able to interpret. It's almost like if a person, like, says, okay, I'm going to accept God's hand in things, I will look at it that way, and through that way of looking through that lens, I'll be able to see. So what did he see in these two dreams that allowed him to interpret the dream correctly? Okay, so what are them? So the first one was, on the vine were three branches. It had barley budded. When out came its blossoms and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and placed the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Joseph said, this is the interpretation, the three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will pardon you and restore you to your post. You will place Pharaoh's cup in his hand, as your custom formerly when you were his cupbearer. Okay? And then here's where Joseph gets blamed for this line, but think of me when all is well with you again, and do me the kindness of mentioning me to Pharaoh so as to free me from this place.
Yes.
Okay, so he gets, yes. And then look what he says here. In truth, I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, nor have I done anything here that they should have put me into the dungeon. Okay, next. So the Sarah Ophim, the baker, says, wow, fantastic. I like that. Let me tell my dream. My dream, similarly, there were three open work baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket were all kinds of food for Pharaoh that a baker prepares, and the birds were eating it out of the basket above my head. Joseph says, this means 3 days, three baskets, 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head and impale you upon a pole, and the birds will pick at your flesh. And that's what happened. So what did Joseph see in that dream that made him think that he was a dead man? So the Chidah, I think it was the Chidah, he says like this, brilliant. He said, the analogy is a man, an incredibly talented painter. He paints a picture of a man with a basket of apples. And it's like lifelike. Okay? Mm. And the birds come and they come at the basket. They come at the apples. And why? But if it was a person, if a person was alive and they're holding a basket, birds are not coming. They'll only come when there's no human being there. Okay?
Right.
So that's what the Chidah said. What Joseph understood in the dream was that birds sense when something's alive and when it's not alive. The fact that the birds came and ate from the basket indicated to Joseph that this man was a dead man. Because if he was alive, the birds would never, they'd be afraid to come.
Would not have come.
Right, isn't that amazing? So he saw, he understood that. So he said, he looked at these dreams and he said, you can see in the dream itself, if you just look at it and understand nature and how things interact, so therefore he was able to interpret. Later on in next week's stream, when they have this, what Joseph said differently than the other people that were interpreting Pharaoh's dreams was that he understood that the numbers of the seven, the seven cows that were healthy, he was the only one to understand that was talking about time. What it really was, and that's for next week, but basically Joseph understood that dream was about his own life and his family's history. But that's another... We'll leave that for next week.
Very nice.
Okay. Let me just put this on pause.